Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. When I put out the first video about Hendrik Verwoerd, most people were quite happy with the video and they quite liked his character. But one of my European friends left a comment and he said that calling Verwoerd a Hitler is very strong and very wrong. So I asked him, what is it about Verwoerd that you disagree with, this notion that I'm calling him a Hitler? Because you must understand, I'm not the one who originally called Verwoerd a Hitler. It is Jews, liberals, blacks. They refer to Verwoerd as a Hitler. And they hate him. And liberals and Jews constantly draw parallels between Verwoerd and Hitler. You can go and read up about it anywhere. You will see that they constantly, the enemy, tell you that Verwoerd is a Hitler. So it's not something that I've just made up. It is a general feeling, and there's a lot of hatred towards this guy, especially from the Jews, which we will get to. So I sat and thought about it, because my friend never responded to my comment. I sat and thought about it, and then, since I didn't get an answer, I sat and wondered, what is the difference between Verwoerd and George Lincoln Rockwell in America and Hitler? Now, when I spoke about George Lincoln Rockwell in the past, nobody ever had a problem seeing George Lincoln Rockwell as an American Hitler, because George Lincoln Rockwell spoke very strongly. And Rockwell was very firm and very strong, and he comes across very, very powerfully. But there is a difference between Verwoerd and Rockwell. There are a couple of differences between Verwoerd and Rockwell, and they lived at the same time, and they died at about the same time. And both of them were killed by Jews. Jews were behind their deaths. And one of the things that I've pointed out in the past was that in the case of Rockwell, that Jews hated Rockwell to such a degree that there were two attempts on his life. And then, of course, the second attempt got him. And that the same is true for Verwoerd. That Verwoerd also is totally hated. They try to kill him, they don't get it right, and then they come back to kill him again. In fact, in the case of Verwoerd, he suffered much more grievously, because in the first attempt to kill him, unlike with Rockwell, somebody just shot at Rockwell and missed. But in the case of Verwoerd, he was shot straight in his face, and he was lucky to live. And Rockwell's actual end was, let's call it, a much more pleasant death than the death of Verwoerd. Because Verwoerd's death, his final death, was nasty. And the things that Verwoerd went through physically in both cases is really uniquely nasty. But I couldn't understand why my friend had said that calling Verwoerd a Hitler is too strong and it's wrong. So the one thing that I thought about that maybe fools people is the way that Verwoerd speaks. Because in what few videos there are of Verwoerd, and that's another thing, is I am struggling to find video footage of Verwoerd. So there aren't many pieces of film footage of him. And the bits that there are short little bits. I haven't found a full documentary or anything on him. Because another thing about Verwoerd is the Jews hated him to such a degree that they tried to write him completely out of South African history. And that is something that we'll discuss again, where you'll hear it out of the mouths of Jews, that they wanted people to never again ever remember this guy because they hated him with such an intensity. So the one thing that I thought that's different between Verwoerd and Rockwell and Hitler is that unlike Hitler and Rockwell, Verwoerd doesn't come across that powerful when he talks. But there's a difference in background between Verwoerd and Rockwell. And Verwoerd, you must understand, is a professor of sociology. So sociology and psychology is his intellectual background. And I strongly suspect that that is partly where his soft tones and things come from. That he approaches life in that way. And you must understand too that Verwoerd is ruling a country that is where all the whites are entirely Christian, and he himself is a Christian. So there is something to do with his strategy, and somebody else who is well versed in the history of South Africa had said to me that in a sense, Verwoerd approached this racial problem. He approached this whole issue of the racial problem and the politics by sort of quietly doing things in a clever way. That is the way that this person described it to me. This person said that Verwoerd believed in doing things in a sort of a clever way, sort of a cunning way, quietly going about your business and seeing to it that things become what you want them to become. So it's also part of a strategy. And another thing about Verwoerd that you must keep in mind is also keep in mind, for example, two other Nazis in the form of the American George Lincoln Rockwell and Dr. William Pierce. Pierce was a young man at the time that Rockwell was doing his thing, and Pierce totally disagreed with the way that Rockwell was going about things. Dr. William Pierce believed that the way that you needed to win people over was by softening your approach and focusing on intellectual people and going after them. Whereas Rockwell was hitting home very hard. And even the people who were with Rockwell have told me that in the final time that Rockwell lived before he was murdered, that Rockwell was already thinking even of dumping the concept of the Nazi Party, and he was thinking of moving towards something softer that would give him a broader audience. And that is something that I've heard out of the mouths of people who knew Rockwell. And so you must remember that even though Rockwell started off doing hardcore Nazi stuff, never at any time was Rockwell a very big figure. He was shocking a lot of people, but his actual support base was small, and he had to struggle a lot in order to function. Whereas when you deal with Verwoerd, Verwoerd is in charge of a whole country, and the rules are quite a lot more different when you are running a country. You have to be careful what you say, especially if that country is not that powerful. And I want to show you a few things about South Africa. And I want to show you some things about Verwoerd. and about apartheid. The closest thing that I can think of with regard to politics and Dr. Verwoerd is Teddy Roosevelt of America. And Teddy Roosevelt had this statement that he made where he said, "Speak softly and carry a big stick." And the big stick is to go and beat other people with. And I want to show you that in many ways, Verwoerd was exactly that. That he was a guy who spoke very softly and very diplomatically, but make no mistake, behind the scenes, Verwoerd was packing a punch. Another thing that I must tell you as well is that my mentor, who had been in military intelligence, Dr. Chris Jordan, he used to also tell me on a number of occasions that you've got to be careful when you look at diplomatic language. The language of presidents, the language of leaders of countries, the language of governments. All diplomatic language is soft. All of it is soft. You can check it with any country at any time. Diplomatic language is soft, but in those soft words can be hidden very strong statements. Statements that can even indicate war, etc. But it's all done in a very soft, cordial way. Dr. Chris Jordan said to me that you have to watch diplomatic language carefully because they will just say a couple of simple things and you need to look at what they say. They may be sending a strong message, but it will come out as just a few soft sentences. This is how all countries work. So it's one thing for Rockwell to function on his own and just doing his own thing. He's not bound by the same kinds of formal things that the leader of a country is bound by. And you can even see this with Donald Trump. Before Donald Trump was the president, Donald Trump was speaking wildly, speaking in all kinds of bold ways. And then go and compare that Donald Trump to the last 6 months of Donald Trump and the last 6 months of the presidency of Donald Trump. And you'll see a whole different guy. You'll see that there are times when Trump has said something quite wild or implied something quite wild. And then it's as if somebody's come and had a chat to him behind the scenes and they've said to him he's got to come and say something else. And you can even see it in Donald Trump's body language when he was giving statements in his final months. There are times when Donald Trump actually looked very uncomfortable. He wasn't the same Donald Trump that he was when he was a private citizen. Because when you are functioning in a government and there are formal processes that occur between countries, there are other rules at work here. And even slight things that you say will be taken very seriously by other countries. And they may send you quiet letters and things. These are the ways in which the Western world really works. And it's something that I learned while I was also starting to understand politics and stuff. I want to repeat to you that there are lots of things that happen between governments that are very, very quiet. It doesn't get into the news. It's all done behind closed doors. Somebody writes a letter. Some ambassador walks into a president's office. And they may have some very firm, nasty discussions with each other. And not one word of that will ever be published in the newspapers. States function in a different way to the common person. So just be aware of that. I do understand Hitler's oratory and Hitler's appeal and Hitler's professionalism. And it was something that Hitler had to develop to a very high degree. Verwoerd was somewhat different. Verwoerd actually was the editor of a newspaper. When he entered politics, he became the editor of a very influential newspaper. And Verwoerd, in many ways, is closer to Dr. William Pierce, because Verwoerd was also a scientist. He was highly educated, and he functioned in the print media, just like Dr. William Pierce. William Pierce ran printed stuff for decades. And it's only right towards the end, in the age of the internet, that you now have Dr. William Pierce doing those little 11-minute broadcasts. But Verwoerd and Pierce are much closer together in that sense. They are high intellectual thinkers, but they aren't quite the orators of Hitler and Rockwell. And in the case of Hitler, his oratory was his only real thing, because he was struggling so much that he had to develop his oratory to extremely high levels in order to try and get the attention of the German people. Whereas in the case of Verwoerd, Verwoerd came, and I think that in that sense, Verwoerd's newspaper and Dr. William Pierce's approach, you will see that that is how these guys functioned more. But you mustn't think that Verwoerd is a softy. And I'm going to show you some nasty things about apartheid, because I want to show you that the whites didn't play games. And I just want to set some of the scene here so that you grasp exactly what was going on. This guy was no softy. Don't be fooled by his talk. Just because he talks in a soft, psychological, friendly manner doesn't mean that he's a softie, doesn't mean he's a weakling. In actual fact, behind the scenes, this guy gets his way, and the things he gets done, he gets them done. He does the toughest, nastiest things of any white leader in the history of South Africa or Southern Africa. Verwoerd is in a class of his own. And if you see what Verwoerd does, then I doubt you will find an equal in all of America during segregation, etc. You will not find a white man who's his equal when you see what Verwoerd got up to. So I want to show you some things about apartheid quickly. So the full quote from Teddy Roosevelt was, "Speak softly and carry a big stick and you will go far." Teddy Roosevelt was not a guy who mucked around. And he used his big stick in the Caribbean. This is a cartoon from the time. And his big stick was the U.S. Navy. And here's another cartoon of Teddy Roosevelt with his big stick. And you're about to see these whites of South Africa that you think are just a bunch of softies. You're about to see a few things about them. Now, another thing that I just want to put into context here is the population of the whites of South Africa. Verwoerd was ruling South Africa around about 1960. A little bit before that, and for the next couple of years. And I want to show you the population so that you can understand the context within which the whites struggled. So here is a census from 1960, and here are the Africans, the blacks. And if we go right away to the total, the number of blacks in South Africa in 1960 was almost 11 million. They made up 68% of the population. Then if you look at the whites made up 3 million, 19% of the population. So the whites at that point were already outnumbered 5 to 1, more than 5 to 1. The whites back then were already outnumbered more than 5 to 1. So there are you Americans, you're about to go below 50%, and you are already worried at hitting into the 40%, the high end of 40%. But here are the whites of South Africa, and they're already outnumbered 5 to 1. Yet the whites of South Africa are in control of the country, and the whites of South Africa are going to shunt the blacks and everybody else around as they see fit. You can see 9% of the population is colored, 3% is Indian. So the whites are going to be outnumbered 5 to 1, yet the whites are going to kick everyone's ass, and they're going to shunt everybody around on a big scale. And I'm going to show you a little bit about that. So just sit back, those of you who are in Europe, those of you who are in North America, and ask yourself the question, when you are outnumbered 5 to 1 against other races, are you going to be shunting them around and ordering them around in the way that the whites of South Africa did? And I'm going to show you what the whites of South Africa did. Now, among the things that the whites in Southern Africa did that are different to what you've done in North America, etc., is there were rules that whites started implementing. Whites started making things illegal. And for example, in this photograph, it says, mass meeting at Durban in May 1950 to protest the Group Areas Bill and the Suppression of Communism Bill. Over 20,000 people joined in. The meeting was held under the joint auspices of the African National Congress, the Natal Indian Congress, and the Colored People Organization. Now, the Jews and the blacks and the Indians, they dived in, and the Jews especially were pushing these things. They were all against this stuff of the Group Areas Act. Now, the Group Areas Act was to start segregation. And it was going to be that whites are going to live here, blacks are going to live there, etc., etc. So this is what apartheid was about. It was to take people and start shunting them around and create segregation. That is what apartheid was about. And there were many blacks and others who were living in areas where they were going to be moved from. Now, although the Jews were upset by this, the Jews were regarded as whites and they lived in the white areas. So the Jews aren't going to be physically affected by this, but the Jews can already see that whites are already moving down that Nazi path, down that Nazi racist path, and that's already freaking the Jews out. Again, we're going to get back to that again, and we're going to deal with that in another video. So the Jews can already see these whites are getting racist, they need to control them, and they're already throwing their chips in and working with the blacks, etc., and the commies. Now, another thing that the whites did in South Africa was the Suppression of Communism Act. And they made the practice of communism illegal. So you can't be a communist in South Africa. And by the way, the same thing happened in Rhodesia. There was a suppression of communism in Rhodesia as well. You can't go and convince people to read Karl Marx and to talk your communist crap. You can't come and talk your Jewish Bolshevik crap in society. That's illegal. End of story. So these are things that whites did to make stuff illegal and to start stopping these non-whites and Jews and commies from functioning in South Africa. And here you can see large numbers of blacks being gathered together in order to protest against this. Notice though, in these days, all these non-whites are sitting there on chairs. Nobody is busy burning anything down. because society used to be much more polite than it is nowadays. And another part of it was that apartheid was intended to split the country up. And the idea was ultimately that there's the majority of South Africa under apartheid, the majority of South Africa will be white. And then blacks are going to have their areas where they live, but the blacks are not going to be really considered citizens of a white country. The blacks are going to be citizens of a black country. And when those blacks come to work in the white country, which is where most of them want to come and work, then they've got to carry a thing called a pass. A pass is like an ID book. It's like a passport. It's a physical document to say, this is my number, this is the country I live in, and I'm a temporary worker in the white country. And so here are the blacks, black women, protesting the pass laws. The whites are really busy sorting these non-whites out, saying you're going to have to carry a pass. If a non-white is caught in the white area without his pass, that's a criminal offense. The police are going to lock him up straight away. These whites didn't play games under apartheid. I want to make that clear to you, that the whites did not play games, that these were criminal offenses, and the police would sort them out quickly. And remember again, this is 19% of the population is in charge of the other large portion of the population. And that 19% is making the rules and kicking ass. They're not mucking around. And for the non-whites, it's unpleasant. In the days when I was a kid, on the rare occasions that I came to South Africa, before actually coming to live here, I only came to South Africa about twice or three times when I was a kid, before we actually came to live here. Wherever you went, you had signs like this all across South Africa, in every freaking corner of every flipping town and city, you would see signs like this, which say white area. And it's always in two languages, because it's English and Afrikaans. White area in English, and in Afrikaans, blanke gebied. And that's just Afrikaans for saying white area. And you'd see these things everywhere in South Africa. Here's another sign, for use by white persons. And the Afrikaans says, vir gebruik deur blankes. So there you've got it, you know. All over South Africa, in every freaking place. Here's a park. Take a look at this. Now, this is much more like Rhodesia as well. Here, it doesn't say white. It says European children. You see, on the sign, it says, for European children only. When I was a kid in Rhodesia, we didn't talk about black and white. The actual term that we used was European. And there is obviously a time where the terms started changing in a subtle manner. And so sometimes you'll see the term European being used, and then white becomes more and more common. But here you've got an example. This park is only for white kids, and it says European children. Here is a train station. And here you can see a telegraph office, and it says Telegraph Office Non-Europeans, and in Afrikaans, Telegraph Kantoor Nie Blankes. And so there you can see Telegraph Office for non-whites here. And then next to it, you see Telegraph Office Europeans Only. They had duplicates of everything. When I was a kid, whether it was in South Africa or Rhodesia, if you walked in a town and you needed to go to the toilet, the toilets said, toilets for whites only, toilets for blacks only. And let me just take this time to just mention the Rhodesians. The Rhodesians nowadays like to pretend that they were all liberal and all that. That's just a whole bunch of claptrap. Unfortunately, I don't have photos of instances in Rhodesia where you can see whites only or Europeans only. But in Rhodesia, it existed. When I was a kid, all the toilets, you had toilets for whites and you had toilets for non-whites. End of story. That's how it was in Rhodesia. Rhodesia also had a kind of a Group Areas Act. They didn't move the non-whites there. The non-whites had been living like that all along because some of these things are hangovers from the times of British rule. And you must remember, in colonial times, 100 years ago, 100 and more years ago in colonial times, there was racial segregation, end of story, everywhere, in all colonies, everywhere. So, returning to this photo here, in this case, it doesn't say whites and non-whites, it says Europeans. It says Europeans and non-Europeans. So you see the interchangeability of these terms. Here's some more. Here you can see in a park, it says European ladies, Blanca Damas, European gentlemen. And then here you can see for the non-whites, and here they've even got more than one language. They've got one of the black languages, possibly Zulu, I don't know. The railway carriages. When I came to South Africa and you climbed on a train, there would be railway carriages for whites only. And then there'd be railway carriages for blacks only. It just goes on and on and on. South Africa was like that right throughout. There were taxis only for whites, etc. All of South Africa was segregated. Everything. And Rhodesia was not that different either, though the Rhodesians like to nowadays pretend that they were liberals all the time. That's just garbage, that's just rubbish. Whites used to be very racist. But now let's get on to the business of removals. These whites started taking South Africa, which at that point, remember, when apartheid became the policy in 1948 as a result of the National Party winning, South Africa had already flirted quite a bit with liberalism under what you could call a white globalist sellout, and his name was General Jan Smuts. General Jan Smuts was closely associated with the Jews. He was like Nelson Mandela. He was an attorney who worked with Jews. His clients were Zionists, etc. Just like Nelson Mandela, you'll find that in actual fact that there are a lot of similarities between this white guy, General Jan Smuts, and Nelson Mandela, the black communist, in that both of them are linked to Jews. And if you dig more, you'll find out a whole bunch more about it. So you had this Jan Smuts, who was a British-loving liberal, and he was doing everything he could to make the British happy. He was Winston Churchill's best friend. Jan Smuts even played a role in the creation of Israel. He had a lot of influence, and he was the only white leader who was loved by globalists, etc., Jan Smuts. And then came apartheid. And when apartheid came in 1948, that was the path towards racism. And that changed things. So you had quite a lot of liberalism that had existed in South Africa. And now in come the racists. And it starts off with Dr. Malan, a Christian priest. Then you have Strydom, the Lion of the North, and then you have Verwoerd. But Verwoerd gets the most stuff done. And what these whites now do is they start changing borders, start creating countries, start saying to the non-whites, you live in this suburb, time for you to get out, here's where you're going to go and live. I should also mention, by the way, that whites generally and white civilization is tough and hard. And in actual fact, all these things that in this liberal day and age of madness that you think, oh, this is so terrible, it's so hideous. If you actually go and look at European history, you will find that in European history, there were times when people were forced to stay in certain places, that you couldn't just move from one town to another. Recently, I was looking and reading a bit about some Russian history, and there were firm rules in Russian history at certain points where for you to move from one town to another, you'd have to go and get permission. You can't just go and live in any freaking place you want to live. So one of the things that you've got to understand about white civilization is that there are lots of rules in white countries in the past that by today's standards would be regarded as very harsh. And that is all part and parcel of how whites live and how whites run countries. And I personally think that a bunch of those old rules have got a lot of validity. There are things that need to come back. You can't just run around like a lunatic. There are things that sometimes have to be done, and it's not pleasant, and people have to do it. Western civilization is not a bunch of soft weaklings, and it never has been. And there are many aspects of it that are very necessary. But anyway, let's return to here. So, all I just want to make clear is that don't just think that whites just kick blacks around. Whites in prior times also kick whites around. White rule and white government and white-run countries, there are times when there are very firm laws because it is beneficial to the country. So that's all that I want to point out there. So let's go and take a look at forced removals, where they start taking these non-whites and they start moving them. And they say, listen, you live in this suburb, but this suburb is now going to be white, and you're going to be out of here. So another thing is also, there aren't that many photographs of these removals and things. And I wish I could find more because this stuff, there was tough, nasty stuff that went on here. Here you can see a photo, and this is a black guy, and I think he's sitting on a truck, and this is him and his furniture and stuff, and he's on his way, okay? This is part of the forced removals. He's being sent off. He's going to live in a new place. End of story. The whites have given the orders, and it's going to happen. And you must not forget that there were white policemen. The government came, the white cops came, and they came and they made things happen. And if people resisted them, those people got a beating, those people got arrested. The whites shunted people around and they used force. They didn't play games. So you have Dr. Verwoerd saying, oh, well, you know, we wish these other people well. And, you know, we wish them a good future, etc. But meanwhile, behind the scenes, if there's any kind of problems or any kind of rebellion or anything, Verwoerd's police and army are in there and they're busy kicking people's asses and they're sorting things out. And in the time of Verwoerd, this stuff, Verwoerd was the toughest of the lot. Now, here is a story, and this was from the BBC World Service. And here is a better photograph, and it's from 2015. And it says, the town destroyed to stop black and white people mixing. And you'll find that there are places in the Cape, a place that they often cry about is a place called District 6. And District 6 was also a place where they went and they did their thing. But in this case, this is a place called Sophia Town. And so here you can see all these trucks, all these pickup trucks, And they're filled with people and furniture. And they're on their way, man. The whites have moved them out. But now I want to show you that in all these pictures that you're seeing here, you're not seeing anything really nasty. And I've not come across any film footage showing these things. Because there's got to be more to this, but it could also be that the government, when they were doing these things, that journalists, etc., were not really allowed around there. And that some nasty, nasty things were going on. And I may be able to show you just a little bit, give you an idea of how unpleasant this business was. Because these people being forced to move, they obviously are not happy with it. And you've seen protests, etc. Now I want to show you a bit more. This is from a local newspaper in my area. And more than a year ago, one day in this little newspaper, they had this story. And it was about Sophia Town. Because Sophia Town is actually a neighborhood very close to where I live. It's literally almost next door to the suburb I live in. And so here's the story, Sophia Town's evil destruction. Now here on the bottom, you can see some more. So let me just read this to you quickly. It says, 1 August marked 64 years since the Natives Resettlement Act resulted in the forced removals of residents. With land ownership and expropriation on the lips of politicians, that's now in 2019, 2020, business people and ordinary citizens, this day acts as a reminder of the horrendous history of land-related issues in our country. It was on 1 August that the apartheid government passed the Natives Resettlement Act, number 19 of 1954. This act empowered the government to remove people of color from any area within and next to the magisterial district of Johannesburg, according to South African History Online. This was the exact law used by the government to violently remove Africans, Coloureds, Indians, and Chinese living in Sophia Town less than a year after it was passed. The nationalist government deployed security police to Sophia Town in January 1955 in anticipation of major resistance against the forced removals. People were manhandled onto trucks and their belongings haphazardly loaded and driven to remote locations where they were forced to live. So I'm going to show you some more close-ups here. So here's a close-up of that same article. And here you can see these blacks. And there they've written on a wall, "We won't move." But it doesn't matter what they say. The whites come and the whites kick them out. So this, and to show you how nasty it was, this is the only photograph I can find of what Sophia Town looked like. And it says here, a woman and her child walk over the rubble left behind after the Sophia Town removals. And this is the only photograph I can find of Sophia Town in that time. Look at these buildings. They are freaking broken down. It's like there was a war. And that will give you an idea that these blacks and other non-whites, they resisted, they hated being moved out, and the end result was nasty. So until somebody can get me more photographs or any video footage, this may be the only thing that I have to show you that this stuff was nasty. And the scale of it is what I'm going to show you in the videos to come. We're going to take a look at apartheid, and we're going to look at what is going on, and we will look at what is said. And here is the kicker for you. The white population of South Africa was 3 million. During the time of apartheid, the whites moved and resettled 3.1 million people. I repeat, during the time of apartheid, the whites moved and forcefully resettled more than 3.1 million people. And Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd was the major role player in these kinds of things. So you mustn't be fooled by Verwoerd sitting there in these videos and Verwoerd saying things like to the black leaders of Africa, "Oh, we wish you well, we wish you well, and we are going to be good neighbors, and we're going to be very pleasant to each other," because Verwoerd is busy kicking these people out by the hundreds of thousands and shoving them into places and saying, "You're going to live there, I'm going to create that country over there, that's going to be your capital, that's where you're going to live, you're going to go and live there. The rest of you, you're going to go and live there. Those of you who are in this area, you get out of here." And that kind of thing. These are the things that they did under apartheid. So don't be fooled by Verwoerd and his quiet talk. These whites kicked ass. These whites shunted non-whites around. And they didn't muck around. And they used force. They beat them. They arrested them. They did what they needed to do. And I want to make it clear to you that apartheid, though everybody, though the whites of South Africa nowadays, like the Rhodesians, try to pretend that the whites weren't that firm and the whites were this and the whites were that. The fact of the matter is that when the whites were large and in charge, and the whites decided that things had to be done, they did it, and they did it using whatever force. Can any of you imagine any of this happening in the United States or Europe or Britain? No, you wouldn't. But the whites of South Africa did it. And just as an aside, the only time that I know that whites moved people on a large scale was during war. And I know that the Americans in Vietnam resettled people during a war. Rhodesia, the whites of Rhodesia also resettled blacks during war, as did the Portuguese. We had a concept called protected villages. And in Rhodesia, we moved something like 300,000 blacks from their existing villages into new villages that where we told them they must go and live. And it had to do with a war strategy. So what I want to make clear to you is that whites in Africa moved non-whites around and shunted them around and kicked them around when that was our policy. We were not a bunch of wusses. Our people, even outnumbered as we were, we made rules and we forced these people to do what we wanted them to do. Things which today would be absolutely unthinkable in modern Europe, in modern America. And these things were done after World War II. So we had no Germany to protect us. We had to do these things while facing up to the nasty politics of the Western world criticizing us, etc. So don't be fooled by Verwoerd and his soft talk, saying to blacks, "Oh, we're good neighbors and we wish you well and we hope that you will do well." He's busy kicking them around and reorganizing South Africa, creating borders, creating countries, etc., as he deems is best for whites. And that is how this guy functioned. And that is how the apartheid system functioned. Apartheid was developed for the benefit of whites. End of story. That is why everybody else goes crazy about it. Because the whites did this. And you should ask yourself, how can the whites manage to pull this off and shunt these people around and physically remove them and do all these things to them while being vastly outnumbered? You have to give credit to these whites that they were even able to do these things. There they are, 19% of the population, and they're busy shunting the other 81% of the population around at will. Think about that. The whites of Southern Africa were not a bunch of wusses, and the whites of South Africa under apartheid were not a bunch of babies. They were much tougher than you would think. Here is a short video that describes apartheid, and I just want to make a few comments about it. In here, it talks about the similarity between the Indian reservations in Canada and apartheid. And yes, that's the same business. And in here, it says that 3.5 million people were moved between 1960 and 1983. 3.5 million people. And then it says four Bantustans were fully independent, and that means that they were prepared for international acceptance. They had parliaments, they had an army, they had a constitution, etc. And by South African law, they were totally independent states. However, nobody else recognized them, although everything was done to prepare them for that. It also mentions other things like the Torch Commando. This is where you get white liberals who are probably gathered together also by Jews. And they say that the Torch Commando, these are whites who are opposed to apartheid and apartheid's policies, that at their peak they had 250,000 members. And they were saying, oh, they're against fascism. But then they were disbanded when the Suppression of Communism Act came into power in 1950. And it also talks here about ANC. ANC is the ruling party of South Africa. And it says, and 8,000 ANC were arrested. Again, Verwoerd and apartheid weren't a bunch of sissies. They went and they kicked people around, and they arrested, in this particular case, 8,000 ANC. ANC was basically the Communist Front. They were a black political party that had been taken over by communists, and they were working with the Soviet Union. So communism and Jews and liberalism were all buddies in this business. They were all working together.
Hello and welcome to our video summarizing all you need to know about South Africa. We'll examine South Africa's history between 1948 and 1994, essentially the period that South Africa underwent the apartheid system, but also post-apartheid system, with the first post-apartheid president being Nelson Mandela. So let's get started. Now, 1948 was a very important year in South Africa because this was essentially the year where the introduction of apartheid really became far more prevalent. So in 1948, the National Party was elected to power in South Africa. It strengthened the racial segregation that began under Dutch and British colonial rule much earlier on. Taking Canada's Indian Act as a framework, the nationalist government, which was essentially all white, classified all peoples into three races and developed rights and limitations for each. The white minority, less than 20% of the South African population, controlled the vastly larger black majority, the African South Africans. The legally institutionalized segregational framework became known as apartheid. This meant that while whites enjoyed the highest standard living in all of Africa, comparable to first world Western nations, the black majority in South Africa remained disadvantaged by almost every standard, including income, education, housing, and life expectancy. Translated from the Afrikaans meaning apartness, apartheid was essentially the ideology supported by the National Party government and was introduced in South Africa in 1948. Apartheid called for the separate development of different racial groups in South Africa. On paper, it appeared to call for equal development and freedom of cultural expression, but the way it was implemented made this impossible. Apartheid made laws that forced the different racial groups to live separately and develop separately, and also this meant gross inequalities in this level of separation. It also tried to stop all intermarriage and social integration between racial groups. So during apartheid, to have a friendship with someone of a different race generally brought suspicion upon you, or even worse. More so than this, apartheid was a social system which severely disadvantaged the majority of the black population simply because that they did not share the same skin colour as the rulers who were white. Many were kept just above destitution because there were none white. A codified system of racial stratification began to take form in South Africa under the Dutch Empire in the late 18th century, and really this is where the roots of apartheid began. So although informal segregation was present much earlier due to social cleavages between Dutch colonists and a creolized, ethnically diverse slave population, the rapid growth and industrialization of the British Cape Colony in the 19th century meant that racial policies and laws became increasingly rigid. Cape legislation that discriminated specifically against black South Africans began appearing shortly before 1900. Now, the first apartheid law was the Prohibition of Mixed Marriages Act in 1949, followed closely by the Immorality Amendment Act of 1950, which made it illegal for most South African citizens to marry or pursue sexual relationships across racial lines. The Population Registration Act in 1950 classified all South Africans into one of four racial groups based on appearance, known as ancestry, socioeconomic status, and cultural lifestyle. So this was black, white, coloured, and Indian categories, the last of two, which included several sub-classifications. Places of residence were also determined by this racial classification. So between 1960 to 1983, 3.5 million non-white South Africans were removed from their homes and forced into segregated neighbourhoods in one of the largest mass evictions in modern history. Most of these targeted removals were intended to restrict the black population for 10 designated tribal homelands, known as Bantustans, four of which became nominally independent states. The government announced that relocated persons would locate the South African, or rather would lose their South African citizenship as they were absorbed into the Bantustans. Organised resistance to Afrikaner nationalism was not confined exclusively to activists of the oppressed dark-skinned population. So of course, this very harsh apartheid system did draw huge resistance across the board. So a movement known as the Torch Commando was formed in the 1950s, led by white war veterans who had fought fascism in Europe and North Africa during World War II, only to find fascism on the rise in South Africa when they returned home. With 250,000 paid-up members at the height of its existence, it was the largest white protest movement in the country's history. By 1952, however, the brief flame of mass-based white radicalism was extinguished when the Torch Commando disbanded due to the government legislation under the Suppression of Communism Act of 1950. Some members of the Torch Commando subsequently became leading figures in the armed wing of the banned African National Congress, known as the ANC. Now, to go into a little bit of depth about the ANC. So from the 1940s to the 1960s, anti-apartheid resistance within the country took form mainly of passive resistance, influenced in part by the pacifist ideology of Mahatma Gandhi in India. After the March 1960 massacre of 69 peaceful demonstrators in Sharpeville, the subsequent declaration of state emergency, and the banning of anti-apartheid parties, including the African National Congress, the ANC, the Pan-Africanist Congress, the PAC, and the Communist Party of South Africa, the focus of national resistance turned to armed struggle and underground activity. The history of resistance by the ANC goes through three phases. The first was a dialogue and petition, the second direct opposition, and the last a period of exiled armed struggle. In 1949, just after apartheid was introduced, the ANC started on a more militant path, with the Youth League playing a more important role. The ANC introduced a programme of action in 1949, supporting strike action, protests, and other forms of non-violent resistance. Nelson Mandela, Oliver Tambo, and Walter Sisulu started to play an important role in the ANC in this period. In 1952, the ANC started the Defiance Campaign, and this campaign essentially called on people to purposefully break apartheid laws and offer themselves for arrest. It was hoped that the increase in prisoners would cause the system to collapse and get international support for the ANC. Black people got onto white buses, used white toilets, and entered white areas and refused to use passes. Despite 8,000 people ending up in jail, the ANC caused no threat to this apartheid regime. The armed wing of the ANC, Umkhonto weSizwe, abbreviation MK meaning Spear of the Nation, claimed moral legitimacy for the resort to violence on the grounds of unnecessary defense and just war. From the 1960s until 1989, MK carried out numerous acts of sabotage and attacks on military, police and personnel. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission noted in 2003 that, despite the ANC's stated policy of attacking only military and police targets, the majority of casualties were civilians. The National Liberation Movement was divided in the early 1960s when an Africanist faction within the ANC objected to an alliance between the ANC and the Communist Party of South Africa. Leaders of the Communist Party of South Africa were mostly white. Hence, the Africanists broke away from the ANC to form the Pan-Africanist Congress and its military wing named POCO, which became active mainly in the Cape Provinces. During the early 1990s, POCO was renamed Azanian People's Liberation Army, APLA. Its underground cells conducted arms robberies to raise funds and obtain weapons and vehicles. Civilians were killed or injured in many of these robberies. In 1993, attacks on white civilian targets in public places increased. APLA denied the attacks were racist in character, claiming that they were directed against the apartheid governments as all whites, according to the PAC, were complicit in the policy of apartheid. An attack on a Christian church in Cape Town in 1993 left 11 people dead and 58 injured. Now, of course, the most famous figure to emerge from apartheid but equally the anti-apartheid resistance movement was Nelson Mandela, who was the first post-apartheid president. So on 5th August 1962, police captured Mandela along with fellow activist Cecil Williams near Horwick in South Africa. Many MK members suspected that the authorities had been tipped off with regards to Mandela's whereabouts, although Mandela himself gave these ideas little credence. In later years, Donald Rickard, a former American diplomat, revealed that the Central Intelligence Agency, who feared Mandela's association with communists, had informed the South African police of his location. Jailed in Johannesburg's Marshall Square prison, Mandela was charged with inciting workers' strikes and leaving the country without permission. Representing himself with Slovo as legal advisor, Mandela intended to use the trial to showcase the ANC's moral opposition to racism while supporters demonstrated outside the court. He moved to Pretoria, where Winnie could visit him, and there he began a correspondence series, studies rather, for a Bachelor of Laws degree from the University of London International Programmes. His hearing, however, began in October, but he disrupted the proceedings by wearing a traditional kaross, refusing to call any witnesses, and turning his plea of mitigation into a political speech.
Here is another short video about apartheid, and it's much more critical. But it's got some good film footage in it. So it's got some interesting film footage in there. So again, there's the issue of homelands. A homeland and a Bantustan is the same thing. It's the same as an Indian reservation. And I just want to talk about a couple of points because there are so many points in these short videos. I don't have time to tackle all of them, but I do want to mention a few outright lies and just utter junk. When they say that homelands were on the worst farmland, that's a lie. And I've seen that with my own eyes down in the Eastern Cape, where I've gone through what was a Bantustan or a homeland, and I've taken photographs, and I can tell you that the notion that they were given the worst farmland is a lie. It depended on the location and it depended on the tribe and where that tribe's normal homeland was. So some were better than others, but I've seen with my own eyes wonderful places where blacks could live and they could go and farm and do what they wanted to do. They could build a house anywhere they wanted to, and I've got the photographs to show you. But we're not going to deal with that. This is not a whole video about apartheid. I just want to touch base on that. And you will find whites living and farming in parts of South Africa that are so nasty that you won't find any blacks there. For example, the Karoo. If you go to the Karoo, going to the Karoo is like going to the freaking moon. Okay? There's not a tree in sight for miles and miles. Everything is dead. It's rocks up to as far as the eye can see, up to the horizon. You will find many whites who've grown up in the Karoo. They love the Karoo. The Karoo looks like the fucking moon. It's not a place I'd like to live. I've got buddies who live in the western side of South Africa, bordering on Botswana and Namibia and those places. Also, not places you'd want to live. And you won't find any black homelands there. You'll find whites living in places where no black would live. And the whites are quite happy. They've got farms there and they farm as best they can in that environment. So one of the biggest lies you'll hear about apartheid is, oh, the whites all took the best land and all the worst land was given to blacks. Total garbage. It depended on where that tribe was and where their original homeland was. And I repeat, the worst farmland in all of South Africa is occupied by whites. Go down to the Karoo, go down to those miserable places in the south and the southwest, you'll find lots of whites there. The guy in this video also makes the mistake about the sports boycott. He tries to claim that the sports boycott resulted in sort of mixed results. He actually gets it all wrong. He says that South Africa did great in cricket and rugby after the years of the sports boycott, but that we did bad in soccer. What he doesn't tell you is that cricket and rugby were primarily white games where most of the sports people in them were white. And soccer is a black sport in South Africa. In Africa, the blacks love soccer. It's a European game, but the blacks in Africa love soccer and they suck at it. So it's got absolutely nothing to do with the mixed results. It's got to do with the teams. And these blacks are not that good at soccer, and the whites, when they play their cricket and their rugby, they do well. But now, of course, they've been mixing up the teams and changing the racial composition. But I'm talking about what these teams were like immediately after apartheid. Another thing the guy says is that, oh, apartheid was unsustainable because of, you know, only 16% of the population controls the whole country. Well, how unsustainable is the, let's call it the 1% of America? How sustainable is that? You see, everyone beats up on the whites of South Africa, but go and look around the world a little bit and you'll see there are all kinds of other elites busy running other parts of the world. So you're always saying, oh, it's only the whites that are unsustainable in South Africa, but all the other elites are sustainable. I don't think so. And what he's not pointing out is that thanks to the whites, the black birth rate shoots through the roof. The reason there are so many blacks is because the white system is looking after them. And the white system in the country is so successful at feeding them. They're not starving to death like in other parts of Africa where blacks have starved to death. You will not find any instance of blacks starving to death in South Africa, Rhodesia, the Portuguese colonies, or even the colonies in the rest of the Africa when the whites were around. There was no starvation to death. But you will find starvation of blacks, blacks starving to death in black-ruled countries after the end of colonialism. These are among the facts they never tell you. Otherwise, there's some interesting film footage and commentary in this, but just be aware of these particular points that I thought were the main ones that I wanted to just say that, you know, this is just junk.
One cannot discuss South Africa without talking about apartheid, the system that governed it for most of its history. From independence until the early 90s, this system of racial segregation impacted almost every facet of society. South Africa's non-white population was kept in check by a series of laws that gave them almost no real political power. This video isn't about the history of apartheid, but a breakdown of how it worked in practice and the laws that kept it in place. For context, let's go over the racial makeup of apartheid-era South Africa. At birth, the South African government issued documents telling people what race they were. The passage of the Population Registration Act in 1950 divided people into four categories: white, colored, Asian, and black. Whites had the highest status and standard of living in South African society. They controlled the government, businesses, and religious organizations in the country. Around two-thirds of whites were Afrikaners, descendants of Dutch settlers from the 18th century. They also spoke Afrikaans, a language very similar to Dutch. The rest were English-speaking descendants from the British Isles. Coloreds were a tier below the whites. Most of them had worked for whites for generations as either servants or employees. Coloreds were kind of a mix of all the ethnic groups in South Africa, having a very diverse background. They wanted whites to treat them as equals, but obviously this didn't happen. Generally, for coloreds, the lighter your skin, the better your status. Asians were the third tier. They were descendants of Indians who came from the British Raj to work under contract on sugar plantations. Most Asians continue to practice Hinduism and still followed the caste system, essentially creating an apartheid within apartheid. Blacks were the majority of the population. They had migrated to South Africa from the north around 1000 CE. They were the lowest tier in South African society and basically just did all the shitty jobs no one else wanted to do. All blacks in South Africa were technically citizens of their homelands, but we'll get into that later. While South Africa had governmental systems for other racial groups, the white government was the only one that held any real power. South Africa had a parliament with 165 members, a prime minister, and a state president, although the position of state president was pretty much symbolic. Only white citizens 18 or older could vote in parliamentary elections. The white government was dominated by the Afrikaner-led National Party for the entirety of the apartheid era. The Asians had an entity called the South African Indian Council. It allowed them to make policies for certain services, such as education, for the Asian community. The coloreds had a similar council, but they voted to abolish it, claiming it had no real power. As I mentioned earlier, the South African government considered blacks to be citizens of their homelands. Homelands were the South African equivalent of American Indian reservations. Each tribe was assigned to a separate homeland. It also just so happened that the homelands were situated on the worst farmland in the country. The South African government treated them as separate nations, claiming to give them increased autonomy, eventually leading to full independence. In reality, these homelands had no real power and only existed to give the appearance to the outside world that the apartheid government was democratic. Education in South Africa was pretty poor across the board, but it was especially bad for non-white students. White children aged 7 to 16 had to go to school, most of which attended public school. Only about half of white students actually completed high school. Just like white children, colored and Asian children were required to go to school. However, they often faced a shortage of classrooms. Only about 10% of colored children and 25% of Asian children even made it to high school. Blacks in South Africa, much like basically every other area, were treated the worst in education. The passage of the Bantu Education Act in 1953 legally enforced segregation in educational institutions. Until 1981, the South African government didn't even require black children to attend school. Even with this law, only about 20% of black children went to school at all due to the lack of resources from the South African government. The apartheid government deliberately kept blacks poorly educated to ensure they only held low-paying, menial jobs. South African Education Minister Hendrik Verwoerd once said, "There is no place for the Bantu in the European community above the level of certain forms of labor. What is the use of teaching the Bantu child mathematics when it cannot use it in practice?" While higher education was available, it was extremely limited to non-white students. South Africa had 11 white universities compared to only 3 black universities and one each for coloreds and Asians. As a result, attendance was also significantly higher among whites. The limited availability of higher education for non-white students combined with other laws that were in place made upward mobility extremely difficult for the non-white population. South Africa is a nation that is very rich in natural resources. It has the world's largest supply of gold and diamonds. Due to international sanctions as a result of apartheid, South Africa produced almost all its goods domestically. However, the labor force was strictly divided among racial lines designed by the government. The labor market remained segregated through the job reservation system. As the name implies, certain jobs were reserved for certain races. This basically ensured that all the high-paying, skilled labor was only available to whites, while non-whites were left with the low-paying, unskilled labor. Job reservation laws also led to a shortage of skilled labor, which provoked efforts to ease the laws by the early 80s. Due to the fact that black homelands were completely neglected by the government, it was pretty much impossible for blacks to find work within their homelands. As a result, most were forced to leave their families behind to find work in gold mines or on farms long distances from home, although companies were given financial incentives to put factories closer to homelands. White citizens were required to serve in the South African Defense Force, the nation's armed forces. The army was used for internal suppression of the resistance to apartheid and the countless active conflicts the country was involved in under the apartheid government, such as the South African Border War and Portuguese Colonial War. The media in South Africa was very tightly controlled under the apartheid government. All radio and television stations were state-owned, and the Publications Control Board would review all plays, books, etc. to determine if it could be seen by the South African public. If the board felt that a work was obscene or touched too much on racial issues, it would not be allowed. As a result, countless works were banned, and many artists were not allowed to publish within their own country. South Africa was subject to an international sports boycott as a result of apartheid. Until the early 90s, the IOC, the ICC, the IRB, FIFA, and many other international sports organizations had banned South Africa. This resulted in a generation of athletes who had never performed outside of domestic leagues. The impact of this boycott on South Africa's international performance is mixed. While South Africa has performed poorly in the FIFA World Cup, they have done okay in the Cricket World Cup and have won two Rugby World Cups since the end of apartheid. The system of apartheid has had far-reaching impacts on South African society. The consequences are still being felt almost 25 years later as black South Africans remain uneducated as a result of deliberate government action under apartheid. Regardless of your opinion on apartheid, the fact remains that the system simply wasn't sustainable. You simply can't have a system where 16% of the population lives comfortably at the expense of 84% of the population and expect that system to last forever. Such a system is almost destined to face deep resentment and instability.
In the next video you're going to see, this is from the 1970s. And in this one, you're going to hear Bishop Tutu, and he's talking about the Bantustans. The Bantustans were countries created for blacks. Some were truly independent, and by truly independent, they actually made them such that according to South African law, these countries were no longer a part of South Africa. The problem was that the rest of the world refused to recognize them as independent countries, but to all intents and purposes they were 100% independent of South Africa, but the rest of the world collectively chose to ignore that. So the whites of South Africa did give 100% full independence to other blacks in some of the Bantustans, but the rest of the world wasn't going to go by that, and they ignored that. Then the other Bantustans were still like a part of South Africa with partial independence. But these Bantustans are basically black countries, and these are blacks, ruling blacks. They got their own constitution, they got their own stuff. So what you will see in here is that Bishop Tutu, he's a black guy, and Bishop Tutu talks about, oh, this is so terrible, these people are dehumanized, etc. They moved to a country that's theirs now, and they're told, listen, here's your place, this is your territory, go do with it what you want to do. And now that's a bad thing. In many respects with whites, you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. But this will just give you some kind of idea of how they now complain about how bad it is when they are blacks among blacks. If you had to go and give whites even South African whites, a chunk of desert tomorrow. And you had to say, listen, hey, all you whites who want to move into that desert, you can go live there tomorrow and you can do in there what you want to do. I can tell you there'd be streams of whites dashing off to the desert. And we've got semi-desert here in South Africa, and we've got white farmers who buy farms in the semi-desert and they live there and they farm there in a semi-desert, a place that looks like the freaking moon. Now, if you had to go and say to whites, hey, you can go live there, do what you want to do. If blacks would allow us to do what we allowed blacks to do, you'd see freaking streams of whites dashing off there in a second. Because when you live in your Bantustan, you don't have to buy land or anything. You don't have to buy property. You can go and build a house wherever you want to. So I don't want to go too much into that, but that is how the system functioned. And you just hear, oh no, it's so terrible, it's so horrible. Meanwhile, it's blacks living among blacks, ruled by blacks, no whites around, and you'll just hear, oh, it was so horrible, so terrible. Anyway, so that's that. But there was a day once when I worked in my final years in the corporate world here in South Africa, where a black from Zimbabwe, because by then already quite a few blacks from Zimbabwe were living here in South Africa, and some of them were computer programmers. And one of them turned around and said to other people, he said that if you were to take white people and stick them in the desert, that they'd make a success of it. And then he gave as his example Las Vegas. But anyway, there's a black guy, and he said, if you take white people and you stick them even in the desert, they'll make a success of it. So that is how others see us. We don't see ourselves that way, but we really should. And there was one of the few blacks who actually just came out and told the raw truth. But anyway, here is Bishop Tutu, and you're going to hear all this moaning and groaning, and in this case, moaning and groaning about being resettled in a black area run by blacks, only blacks. If you had to do that to whites, whites would love it. They'd say, let's go for it. And those shacks and things that you see there, I have been to places in South Africa, squatter camps and places where whites did live in shacks. And whites did improve on it, and they did come right. That I've seen with my own eyes, and I have the photographs to prove it.
In February 1978, the Minister of Plural Relations gave expression to the implications of the Verwoerd dream for South Africa. If our policy is taken to its logical conclusion, as far as the black man is concerned, there will be not one black man with South African citizenship. Their policy, apartheid and the Bantustan plan. Its logical conclusion, dispossession, impoverishment and dehumanization. 18 million blacks, 71% of South Africa's total population, had been allocated 14% of the land, fragmented into 10 Bantustans. Every black person would be compelled to accept citizenship of a Bantustan, and being deprived of all citizenship rights in the rest of South Africa, be tolerated as a guest worker, living in the Bantustan and entering South Africa as a migrant laborer. In the implementation of this master plan between 1950 and 1980, roughly 2,115,000 black people were uprooted from their homes in white South Africa and dumped in Bantustan relocation camps, similar to this one at Compensation in the Mpentle district of Natal. Relentlessly, this relocation program continues, with over 1,700,000 blacks in the rural areas facing uprootal. The financial cost of this final phase estimated at 390 million rand. The cost in human suffering and misery immeasurable. Bishop Desmond Tutu.
Well, I've visited quite a few of these so-called resettlement camps, which is a nice name for dumping grounds for human beings who are uprooted from their former homes where they lived as a family, near the place of work of the breadwinner, and they are dumped in these arid areas in the Bantustans. There is not very much work around the resettlement camps. There isn't very much food available. The able-bodied men are away working as migrant laborers, and the women and the old and the very young try to eke out a miserable existence. This particular visit to a resettlement camp outside Queenstown called Zweledinga, which in many respects was typical of all resettlement camps in its poverty, in the anguish of the people. I met a little girl who just came out of a shed in which she lived with a widowed mother and a sister. And I asked her, "Does your mother get a grant or a pension or something?" And she said, "No." Then I said, "Well, what do you do for food?" And she said, "We borrow food." And you look around the camp and wonder who would be able to lend anybody food since their resources seemed so minimal. And I said, "What happens if you can't borrow food?" And she said, "We drink water to fill our stomachs." And that is the sort of experience that is widespread. People were being made to starve, not because there's no food in South Africa, but they were being made to starve for ideological reasons, by deliberate government policy. And I have vowed that it's a system that we will have to do everything in our power to see stopped.
Here is quite a detailed little documentary film about apartheid done back then. And you've got a white liberal journalist from America, and he's busy going into a place and he's going to check it out. But you will hear in this commentary, you'll also hear that there are times when the situation is dangerous. You'll hear there are times when the whites are warned not to go into certain areas. You'll hear the commentators saying that. I'm just going to make a couple of simple points about this, because like I say, the purpose of this is not to go into a whole bunch of detail about apartheid. It's just to sketch for you a good outline about apartheid and some things about it. Just to show you that apartheid wasn't some wussified system and these whites weren't just bending their knees. These whites were kicking ass. Now, one of the things that comes out here is that the guy says at a point, all opposition to apartheid is moral and ethical. And this basically boils down to, let's call it, emotional opposition to apartheid. Whenever I've seen opposition to apartheid and arguments against apartheid, it was all about morals and ethics, and Christians were all feeling bad about apartheid, etc., etc. And you'll find all these Englishmen and all these Christians running around and they are talking about the terrible ethical things about apartheid. But again, I just want to tell you, the world is not such a soft, wussified place. When somebody else gets the chance to control you, they do, okay? And don't you believe that whites are the only ones who would look out for their own well-being. Make no mistake, blacks have done it, etc. But what you've got are these churches, and in South Africa, the main church of the whites, of the Afrikaans speakers, was known as the Dutch Reformed Church. And the Dutch Reformed Church in its day was supposed to be the church that upheld apartheid. And you can see in this documentary that even back then, when this white liberal journalist is questioning this Dutch Reformed guy, the Dutch Reformed guy is jumping around and he's not very comfortable defending this thing. Though when I was a kid, people were much more racist, and they simply looked at these things and they said, you know, this is how it is, these people are not our equals, etc., etc. But in here you can see that the guy is struggling to defend it. And you'll see that in quite a few of these videos. Then there's a guy called Mr. Prinsloo, who is from the department that does separate development. Mr. Prinsloo actually tells it in a much more straightforward way. And he talks about, we Europeans, we decided this. End of story. You'll also see some other guy being interviewed who talks about the hatred he had for the whites, etc. There's also an Englishman that they interview. I think his surname is Peyton. I think this guy wrote a book called Die the Beloved Country or something like that. In South Africa, you had either these weak English-speaking whites who were buddies with the Jews, or you had Jews outrightly attacking the system. But you had these weak English speakers, and they were ducking and diving on the issues of this and that. You basically can't find a white person who stands up for his own race, okay? So that is the problem that you have, or all these whites who are ducking and diving on moral grounds and things. And that's where guys like Verwoerd and certain other leaders were much, much tougher. And they didn't duck and dive, and they didn't have to bounce around and try and say this and that. They knew what they were onto, and they knew that they were out to look after their own people, which is the white European people. End of story. There's nothing more to say about it. Interestingly enough, in this video, closer to the end of this short documentary, you will actually hear mention of the blacks driving the whites into the sea. And in more recent times, the blacks have threatened that. The more militant blacks have said, we will drive you into the sea. Yeah. That's a lot of big freaking talk, that. But just notice, just be aware that they have said they will drive us into the sea. And they said it back then, and it's said in more recent times. But you just stick around and you watch your history and you watch the future, we'll see who ends up in the sea and who doesn't. Just because someone's got a big mouth and it looks like he thinks he can do it, doesn't mean it's going to happen. Then you'll also see them talking about the blacks and saying, yes, but the blacks are not inferior and this and that. You'll see whites are busy ducking and diving. When the whites are cornered and the whites are asked, are the blacks inferior? Are the blacks unable to learn, etc., etc.? You'll see them ducking and diving. The main thing that I like about apartheid is the description that it is separate development. You learn and live in your way, and I will learn and live in my way. You will think in your way, and I will think in my way. Furthermore, you will also see blacks often being used in this video, where you'll hear them saying, yes, boss, yes, boss. And then you'll hear them saying, yes, boss. Boss is Afrikaans meaning boss. So these blacks are busy saying, yes, boss, either in English or Afrikaans. And again, that is an example. And they obviously are using it in a sort of a mocking way here in this documentary. But yes, this is how it was. Whites were large and in charge. Whites gave the orders. The whites say, you do this, you do that. And you just say, yes, boss. And that's how it used to be. Despite these whites being only 19% of the population. Whites were very dominant in the past, and they've completely lost that self-confidence, etc. And by the way, right near the end of this, you're going to see some blacks, and they're drinking beer. and check those blacks and those enormous, enormous beers that they are drinking. And just a little bit of a point about Africa. In Africa, the blacks have their own beer. It's not like in Europe and America where the blacks and whites are drinking the same beer. In the times of colonialism, there was beer that was made for blacks. They came up with some kind of cheap beer. I'm not sure exactly what the origins are. It's probably based on a beer that the blacks drank from the time when they lived in huts and they had their own societies. Blacks did make some kind of a beer. And it tastes very different to the beer that the whites drink. And you'll see a black with an enormous beer that he's busy drinking. So that is how it used to be. And they had their own stuff that we had factories making beers that was sort of based on their kinds of recipes. But that'll give you some idea of apartheid. But the purpose of this is just to show you that apartheid, the whites were dominant, whites were ordering people around, and if people resisted them, they went and they did what they needed to do. Even though there isn't much in the way of film footage of this. I wish I could find film footage of forced removals. I wish I could find film footage of violent clashes, because there is no question that this was not just some wussified liberal thing. These blacks and non-whites, they hated being shunted around by the whites, but the whites were doing what they had set out to do, which is to see to it that whites are the main beneficiaries and that whites retain control of the country. That is how it was. And whites were not going to give it up, and whites were going to fight communists, etc. This is how whites used to be. They used to be much, much tougher.
This small country store behind me, with a customary crowd of idlers on the front porch, or stoop, as the South Africans call it, might be found in any small rural American community. But the dirt road that runs parallel to this small country store marks the beginning of a location in the town of Nelspruit, the African location where natives are forced to live. Nelspruit, a small mining town in the northern Transvaal, has for the past week been the focus of the racial tension in South Africa. It started with a protest march by some 400 native women on the police station. The women have long been more militant in their resistance to apartheid laws in South Africa than have been their menfolk. And in Nelspruit this week, the African woman has suddenly become the focal point of resistance to the nationalist government. Nelspruit on the surface this rainy, humid day looks as quiet as that scene on that rustic front porch of the store. But in reality, Nelspruit is still tense after a week of trouble. Big trouble and violence, even in South Africa. I asked for permission this morning to go inside the location at Nelspruit and make this film. We were told that there has been trouble there lately and they'd rather not have any Europeans go inside. This, then, is our next recourse. What is behind the firm, continued refusal of African women to accept passes?
Well, the passes have been enforced in South Africa for a very long time among the men. And it has become very clear that the pass system in South Africa is the basis of forced and cheap labor. Now, to impose such a system on the African women is to create hardships. Firstly, African women will have to produce these passes on demand. If they fail to do so, they will be arrested in the streets, they will be stopped at stations, they will be stopped as they visit one another in the locations, and if they haven't got those passes, they will be immediately arrested and brought before the court. Now, African men who value their women just as any other people value their women, say, what will happen to their children?
Ladies, why was the black sash formed in the first place?
Well, the black sash was formed in the first place because the nationalist government introduced the Senate bill into Parliament. It was a bill to expand the size of the Senate to almost double the size of its original size.
And you fear that this would do what?
Well, we felt that it was a legal trick, or we didn't know whether it was legal then, but we felt it was a piece of trickery and against the spirit of the Constitution.
What has been the official government reaction to your protests of mourning?
Government have ridiculed us for mourning. They don't understand, or say they don't understand, why women should stand mourning a constitution. They think we would be much better staying at home and looking after our children.
And obviously you both disagree.
Well, we think that we do look after our children.
We feel very much that this is looking after our children, because after all, it's the future of our children we're worried about. If I had no children, I don't think my interest would be nearly as keen.
In this connection, it's been said that the South African woman, the white woman, occupies a privileged position in the world because of the abundance of servants and cheap labor here. Wouldn't this somehow conflict with what you're trying to do, arouse women to a protest?
Yes, it does. I think that we are very privileged women in that we are not tied to the kitchen sink as so many women are in other parts of the world. And I think that is all the more reason why women should play their full part in the duties of an individual in a democracy. We feel that democracy cannot work unless every individual knows what her obligations are in a democracy.
But I think you're putting the standard of morals very low if you reckon that we are going to go on supporting apartheid just in order to keep our servants.
One final question. Being very realistic, how soon can you hope to take off that black sash?
Well, I'm afraid not in our lifetime.
By far the largest church denomination in the Union of South Africa is the Dutch Reformed Church, with a membership of almost 2 million white and non-white members. With us this morning is Dominee Adrian Burger, Secretary of the Federal Council of Dutch Reformed Churches and editor of Die Volkerkerk, the Transvaal Church magazine. Dominee Burger, you believe in apartheid as a way of life?
Yes, I do.
Why?
In South Africa.
Why is that, sir?
Because the race, which is in a lesser state of development, is by far in the majority here. And numerically, of course, they are much stronger. And because also I believe that it is according to God's will that the white race, which is in the majority in this country, should be preserved. And also everything we have done in the last 300 years and built up in the church and in the state should be preserved and not be swallowed up by an, I wouldn't say inferior race, because I don't believe it is an inferior race, but a lesser a race which is in a lesser state of development, that's all.
You, sir, have been fighting a fight for a long time that requires, as I see it, a great deal of quiet, sustained courage. Don't you ever have a sense of futility, of uselessness?
Well, there come times, of course, when one does feel that you're frustrated in what you're trying to do, and yet, on the other hand, there's a great thrill in it.
Perhaps you can answer this one question that's intrigued me for a long time. There are, I am sure, devout believers in apartheid who are also devout Christians. Can these two, apartheid and Christianity, in your opinion, be reconciled?
I'm quite sure that they cannot. One of the mystifying things to me is how anybody who claims to be a Christian can be a disciple of apartheid.
Do you find any conflict between apartheid and Christianity?
No, certainly not. As a matter of fact, our Dutch Reformed churches are doing much more for the Christianization of the non-white people in this country than any other Protestant church in this country and anywhere in Africa. We as Christians believe in the development of the non-white people, and we certainly try to develop them as far as possible by building their churches, giving, subsidizing them in their church work, and we are also trying to give them leadership where they want it. And our experience is that these people prefer to be left in their own churches. As a matter of fact, there are 9 different non-white churches belonging to the Dutch Reformed Church amongst the non-white people. And they prefer that. There are instances when we come together on a higher level in conferences and sometimes also in their churches. We often come there as white people to visit them, and there are also instances where we even have communion with them.
Can you foresee any eventual end to apartheid in the Dutch Reformed Church?
The Dutch Reformed Church does not practice apartheid because we believe that integration is religiously wrong or ethically wrong. Certainly not. In theory, we have nothing against integration. It's only a matter of practical policy in this country. Now, for this moment, if conditions should change, this or any other practical policy could also be changed.
I see. But is there any corollary, do you think, between American segregation and South African apartheid?
No, I think, in one sense, I think it's all part of a world pattern.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the white race as a whole finds it extremely difficult to realize that they can no longer dominate the whole world. But the thing that encouraged me in America is that in spite of what has happened and is happening, the general trend is in entirely the opposite direction from what is happening in South Africa.
Do you, sir, believe that there's any possibility now or in the immediate foreseeable future of large-scale violence in South Africa?
No, there are a lot of people who seem to be very fearful that this may happen. But for my part, I'm convinced that all the responsible leadership of among the Africans and the Indians is determined at all cost to prevent violence if they can possibly do so.
Mr. Prinsloo, what is the basic philosophy underlying apartheid as a way of life?
We Europeans who've lived in this country for more than 300 years have come to a conclusion which is strange to some people in the Western world, namely that the peoples of Africa, and so the Bantu people of South Africa, have a beautiful civilization of their own, which is worth preserving. There are many facets of this civilization, for instance, the social warmth of the Bantu peoples, which we Westerners can rightly envy them. Now, we also have a peculiar Western adaptation to Africa. Therefore, we can say that the Bantu peoples are a flower, and the Western peoples are a flower, each with a beauty of its own.
I've heard that in the South Africa of today, you can be classified as colored simply by looking colored. Is this, in point of fact, true?
Well, I can give you quite a, which may seem amusing, but rather humiliating incidents that occurred in our country when the Department of Census started reclassifying people. They hauled people of the trams in the mornings out of the bus queues and took them up to the Native Commissioner's office. And some of the tests applied to tell a man that he was not colored was trying to pass a comb through his hair. And the comb stuck, he was told, "You're a Kaffir." Other people whose noses were a bit flat were told, "You're not a colored."
Mr. Prinsloo, as you are no doubt aware, most criticism of apartheid outside the Union is based largely on moral grounds. For example, the morality of separate residential areas in the cities of the Union, past laws, lack of voting rights, and so on. How would you reply to this?
As far as residential areas are concerned, the practical situation is that until about 10 years ago, there were no residential areas for urban Bantu people. It is only in the last few years that such areas were set aside on a planned basis and developed at a terrific pace, as you can see all around you. This housing scheme, which now houses more than 30,000 urban Bantu who work in Pretoria, was a bare plain a mere 4 years ago. I think that is a complete answer to the so-called immorality of separate residential areas. In the political field, we are creating an outlet in that we are proclaiming Bantu authorities in all the major Bantu areas of the Union. We have already brought into life more than 300 such authorities where Bantu who have the inclination, the training, and the moral courage to start developing their own people can do so with all possible assistance from the government.
Is the government convinced that the African wants and accepts apartheid as a development policy?
For obvious reasons, many opponents of this policy tried to influence the Bantu people in the other direction. And like all new philosophies, like all new policies, we had to put our case to the Bantu people. And I can safely say today that the Bantu people are accepting the policy of self-development, which essentially is apartheid essentially is in an ever-increasing tempo. I feel confident that the Bantu leadership of Africa, rural and urban, will, by the turn of next year, show in a most marked way that they are satisfied that this policy leads to their salvation.
Mr. Nakwe, Mr. Prinsloo of the Native Affairs Department told me in Pretoria this week that the African accepts and wants apartheid as a stage of development.
Well,
do you, sir, agree?
Well, Mr. Prinsloo's information and mine, and I can claim to be slightly more informed than Mr. Prinsloo because I live among the Africans and I am an African, cannot be quite correct at all. The African people are realizing that apartheid means nothing else but oppression and exploitation to them. If Mr. Prinsloo's contention is correct, then why do we have these the unrest in the countryside, in the most backward areas of the country? If Mr. Prinsloo's information is also correct, then why do we have the deposition of chiefs? Why do we have the government agents moving around in the urban, in the rural areas to find out what is going on? If the people were so contented, surely it wouldn't be necessary to have so many agents watching over them.
I have had such hatred for every white man that I came across from the earliest days that I could remember. But with the passing of years and having had understanding of fundamental things in life, I have been able to overcome that. But I can assure you that that was one of the greatest struggles that I had to undergo with myself.
Mr. Payton, it's a tall order and a big question, but if you can do it, how would you characterize the emotional climate of South Africa today?
Well, I think probably it's hotter than it's been for a long time.
In what way? In regard to its race problem?
Yes, in regard to the relations between the groups, I suppose the relations between the English-speaking and the Afrikaans-speaking group are colder.
Mm-hmm. In view of the daily indignities, humilities, and in some cases actual hardships, economic and otherwise, that the non-European is subjected to because of the apartheid laws, do you ever wonder at or puzzle that a non-European can ever be civil to a white?
Well, that thought often occurs to me, Mr. McCutcheon, because, you know, we have many non-European friends, and sometimes you do wonder how they can go on liking you, you know.
Do you, Mr. Payton, fear in the foreseeable future any widespread violence in South Africa?
Well, that's what everyone fears. It's not just me. Whether you're a white nationalist or whether you're a black man or whether you're English-speaking, whether you're an Indian, I think all of us have that fear that violence one day will. There will be violence one day.
Mr. Payton, I read a quote by you once, not so long ago, in which, if I can recall it, you said you might hesitate to rush forward to help an African injured on the street. Is that the essence of what you said? Do you recall it?
Oh, yes. Yes, that was quoted in that book, Drum, by Anthony Sampson. And I think it was 1948. I think I've got a bit better since then. But the point I was really trying to make was that in this kind of race-mad world in which we live, that a white man, even if he went to the assistance, might well hesitate before he did. I think you might find that in many parts of the southern states, too.
There's been much talk here, I understand, of passive resistance. As a matter of actual fact, however, can the African, the Indian, or the colored, in his present economic state, financially afford a long period of general strikes or passive resistance?
I would imagine no. You know, you haven't got powerful trade unions here who have built up great funds.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, there are significant things happening. You know, you've heard of the bus boycott.
Yes, I have.
Here in Johannesburg. There was an example where people, by their determination, forced the not only the bus companies, but also the government to retreat.
Mr. Payton, you love this country very much, despite what's been happening here for the past few years and what's happening here today. How does it make you feel when you are aware that your beloved country is the subject of so much worldwide condemnation?
Well, I have so many friends in other countries, Mr. McCutcheon, and I know that I'm not the subject of their condemnation, and I must say that makes it much easier for me to bear, you see. But I understand well the reasons for this condemnation, and much of it is justified. But it doesn't personally make me unhappy, except I would say this, that when I go overseas, I meet people who start condemning South Africa, that very often I find myself, my blood beginning to get warmer, and I find myself defending it. Even defending the government, in fact.
In what examples, for example?
Well, I can give you one very good example. I remember sitting next to a fellow at dinner in San Francisco, and he said to me, "This Dr. Milan of yours must be a very vicious old man." And I said to him, I said, "You know, that's not true. Actually, Dr. Milan is in his own particular white world, he's quite a nice old gentleman. But when he comes into the world of race, and when race morality becomes his supreme morality, which it is, that's what apartheid is, it's race morality, then he will take any step whatsoever to ensure the supremacy of his own people. In other words, Mr. McCutcheon, if you make your own survival your supreme moral value, then you're capable of almost anything, even though you're a nice old man.
Mr. Peyton, as magnificent as this country is physically, aren't there those who find it difficult, if not impossible, to continue living in this climate of fear?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I know quite a number of people who have finally decided to leave the country. Perhaps for their own sakes, perhaps for the sake of their children.
This question of apartheid has been placed, so far as the non-European is concerned, so purely on a question of color, that theoretically, if a black man should come into power in South Africa, is it not possible that the pendulum might swing the other way? Is there any justification to fear that the white man would, in truth, be driven into the sea?
Well, that's a question that lots of people ask and no one can answer, Mr. McCutcheon. I would say that amongst the African people, there are some of them who have, under this present dispensation and the dispensations before it, will come to hate any kind of color discrimination whatsoever. I find it hard to believe. I mean, I don't say the feeling of revenge will be entirely absent, but I find it hard to believe that they could set up a state in which their whole aim would be to discriminate against white people. I find that difficult.
Yes, Master.
Yes, Master.
Yes, Waltz.
Ladies and gentlemen, you know that the series of talks that we have been giving here have been talks designed to describe to you how government works. And you've had talks recently on government and law in general, and also a description of how the parliamentary machine works in South Africa.
Don't you think, Mr. Chairman, that the fear of cultivating the mind of the European people is more work for the liberal to do there than to come and try to cultivate the mind of the African people? Because I think we are capable of doing that on our own self without any advice from any angle whatsoever.
Let us understand that here, in South Africa, and in fact in the whole of Africa, we are dealing with a national question. And Africa is not very peculiar in this respect. Nearly every country has had its national problems. And they are always solved by the people according to the needs of the majority of the people in the particular countries concerned. At the present moment, we don't even have the right to starve.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Pringle, if we could define a term that's intrigued me since you started to use it. You have said repeatedly that the non-European is different from the European. Now, in your mind, is different synonymous with inferior?
I think it is a generally accepted fact today that the non-European is at a lower stage of development than the non-European, than the European. That does not mean to say that they are inherently inferior. Circumstances amongst which they have grown up and, their whole cultural background and everything, their whole diet, which would lead to physical or physiological changes in their whole nervous system, would all lead to a general idea of inferiority amongst you when you compare the average non-European with the European. But I do not believe that the non-European as such is inherently inferior. He's merely at a much lower state of development at the present state of...
Well, let's take up those two.
Yes, boss.
Yes, sir.
Yes, boss. Yes, boss.
Yes, boss.
Yes, boss.
Yes, boss.
Boss.
Yes, boss.
Do you, as a man of sensitivity and intelligence, ever get used to apartheid and what it does to you?
I'm afraid not, because it continuously affronts me. I I'm forced to be indignant about it. I cannot get used to it. I must resist it.
Is it back?
So now that you've seen more of what apartheid really was like behind the scenes, now I'd like to show you again the piece of film footage where Verwoerd is talking about South Africa becoming a republic. So now put this in the perspective of the time. Here you have a man and his actual electorate that votes for him is only 3 million people. It's only 3 million. In a world after Hitler, in a world where the Germans, the Italians are no longer in charge, they don't have any power anymore. They are broken. And so here is a man who leads 3 million whites, and they're outnumbered 5-1 in this country. Over and above that, they've now got enemies jumping up all around the world, even in countries that they thought were their friends, like Britain and America. So he's living in a very hostile world as the leader of 3 million whites who live in a country where they themselves are outnumbered more than 5-1. And he's trying to face up to hostile communists who want violent overthrow, Jews who hate them, and liberals from all across the world who are telling them that what they're doing is wrong. And somehow these whites are also having to face up to all these vast numbers of black nations all across Africa who are also hostile to South Africa and South Africa's policies. So here he's talking, and he's talking very nicely, very politely, and underneath it there is also a firmness that is not obvious. But you've seen in what I've shown you that nasty things have to be done behind the scenes. And here he tries to tell you openly some truths. He talks about the hand of the white man that is hidden. He says that here in South Africa, the hand of the white man is there, and it's obvious here. But elsewhere in other countries, in America, etc., the white man's guiding hand is there as well, but it's all hidden. He's telling you some truths, and he's also saying very politely that, you know, we wish these blacks well, and we wish them to work with us, and we've got this idea for a sort of a union of various nations working together and all these nice things. But the reality is he doesn't believe in the system of liberalism. He himself is seeing to it that his police, that his army is keeping communism down, kicking blacks into place, sorting everybody out, but he does it in a nice, polite, civilized way. And as a final comment, I'll say this to you, that all these others that you've seen who've spoken about apartheid, these other little videos that come from more modern times where people are talking about apartheid, And they're saying, oh, well, you know, apartheid was so unsustainable and the whites did this and therefore the blacks resented them. And if they had not done this, then it would have turned out great. Let me tell you, that's a load of hogwash, okay? That's a load of total crap. And yet that is what Americans and the Western world nowadays believes. They have learned the wrong lesson from Southern Africa, where apartheid gets the blame for everything, where the whites get the blame for doing what they did. I live here, I've studied our history, I've looked at these things. I want to tell you, you are being misled. You are being told, oh well, because the whites did apartheid, that's why everything went wrong. You are not being told the proper history. You are not seeing what happened before apartheid. You are not being told what the whites did and why they did it and the threats that the whites were facing before. All of these things we're not going to touch on here, but you are just told a typical one-sided liberal Jewish type of story where you are told, well, you see, because the whites did this, that's why there was war. You are missing out on all the stuff that came before, all the communism, all the other junk that already existed decades before, the other threats that you don't know about. So be very careful that you don't fall into the trap of, oh, the whites are to blame. It's because the whites did this, that's the why the blacks suffered. Because the whites did this, that's why there was a war. All that is crap. That is not a valid assessment of what actually happened. I'm going to repeat to you that because the whites did these things, they bought themselves decades of self-rule that they would not have had otherwise. If Favut had not done the Republic, the British would have told and forced the whites of South Africa to become a black republic in the 60s. And remember, it's not just the whites of South Africa who were trying to save themselves. The whites of Rhodesia faced exactly the same thing, and it's the same old thing repeated over and over again. So just take a look at Favut, listen carefully to his words, his soft words, now that you've seen the other stuff, the ugly stuff, and realize that these people were trying to save themselves, and they were totally outnumbered inside South Africa, across the African continent, and across the world, and the entire world was turning on the white population of Southern Africa. All of us, Rhodesia, South Africa, they were turning on us and they were working to destroy us. And if it wasn't for what this white man did, the whites would have been screwed decades ago, decades ago. Don't believe the liberal interpretation of South African and African and Southern African history. It's mostly a load of crap. But we can return to this topic of the actual history another day. I've got much more important videos to show you in the meantime. I've got tons of stuff. I could show you many, many things that you haven't seen in any of this. There's lots that happened before this. So here's Favut.
The Republic is the only sure and stable friend that the Western nations have in Africa. We are here to stay, and we are here to aid all others in whatever they may need and can get from us. We have, for a very long time, developed in South Africa a nation of our own, friendly, prosperous, progressive. We hope that the rest of Africa
will become likewise. Fortunately, even former opponents of the Republic, those who were in favor of a monarchy, are now prepared to give it full loyalty and cooperation. We are very happy to be a united people. Of course, there has been sensational journalism and conditioned reporting, which created the impression that there would be great difficulties ahead of us. We have no doubt that all this will pass. Certain restricted measures had to be taken recently, mainly to ensure the protection of the masses, of all races, who seek peace and order. The record of stable government will continue in South Africa. Surely it must be a record, 6 prime ministers and only 5 changes of government in 50 years. However, in the future, we will seek the same form of stability in government, in the Republic, which should ensure stability too in the economic life of the country. Not for us, the sudden constitutional upheavals which created dictatorships in certain parts of Africa, chaos in the Congo, and forms of multiracial government elsewhere which only create the desire for domination by one over the other, without any economic certainty developing. We seek the gradual development of each of our groups in a certain direction. Here the solution is sought by openly retaining the white man's guiding hand, which elsewhere is the hidden guarantee of industrial development and even good administration. Here we follow the example of the nations in creating separate chances of development for each of our racial groups. We seek to give the opportunity for cooperation in a novel way by the creation of a Commonwealth of Southern Africa as our ultimate aim. And in this Commonwealth, cooperation and consultation will be able to take place between all racial groups on the highest level. May this peace and prosperity and aid to all be made possible by the cooperation of our friends in the Western nations.
These are my websites, historyreview.com, africancrisis.info, and white-shop.biz. This is my attempt to try and do some Jew-free trading and experimenting with the next level of stuff. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.